All right, I think we're on.
We are.
Welcome to Blogging Heads. My name is Flint Leverett. I'm a senior research fellow here at the New America Foundation. I also teach international affairs at Penn State and co-publish with Hillary Mann Leverett a blog, www.raceforiran.com.
And I'm Ruel Garecht. I'm a senior fellow at the Foundation Defense of Democracies, and I think that's all the introduction that's necessary.
All right. Well, Ruel, I think they've brought us together today because the issue of Iran and how to deal with it, in particular how to deal with the Iranian nuclear issue, is very much at the top of the news cycle and public debate. It has been for a while, but this week in particular, with the publication of Jeffrey Goldberg's story in The Atlantic, the attention level to this issue is even a little bit higher than usual. And I thought it might be interesting to start well before Jeffrey Goldberg's piece appeared. You had a piece in the Weekly Standard 2 or 3 months ago, which also got, I think it's fair to say, a good deal of attention, laying out the case for, as you saw it, for an Israeli strike against Iran. And maybe as a way to get us into the issue, maybe it would be useful to have you kind of recapitulate what you think are the main points or main reasons why Israel and or the United States, however you'd like to put it, should be thinking seriously about military strikes on Iranian nuclear targets.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Israeli case is pretty straightforward. I actually think it doesn't differ all that much from the American case, with the exception that the Israelis obviously have a lot less that they can throw at this problem. American Air Force and Navy, of course, could pummel the Iranian nuclear program far more effectively than could the Israelis, and that is obviously, I think, a significant consideration. But I mean, to put it very quickly, though I think sufficiently, the Israelis obviously are looking at a regime that is the most virulently anti-Semitic regime I think that the Middle East has ever seen. It is a regime that has an unrivaled track record in terrorism against American and Israeli targets, particularly the Israelis. They have seen that regime supply and aid Israel's worst terrorist enemies. And I might add, if one goes back to the 9/11 report, which I would be happy to read the pertinent sections from, it is, I think, quite striking that anyone would want to allow such a regime that had contact directly and via the Hezbollah with al-Qaeda would want to see them come into possession of nuclear weapons, and that when you're dealing with someone like Ali Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are the most virulent of the virulent, it puts Israel in a real pickle. They have to deal with, I think, what can properly just be described as an existential threat. They're going to have to deal with a world, if the Iranians do get that nuke, I think the proliferation of nuclear weapons throughout the region amongst Arab states, who will probably respond to that. I think Saudi Arabia, which is the arch enemy of Iran for a variety of reasons amongst the Arabs, will go nuclear, I think, or try to go nuclear. They'll try to buy it, I suspect, from the Pakistanis pretty quickly. You're talking about a Middle East that becomes vastly more dangerous for the Israelis. And I think the possibility of a strike, which could become a reality, I mean, if Jeffrey Goldberg's analysis of Israel is right, I think a strike is more likely than not, really offers, I think, the Israelis the only chance of delaying or derailing, either would be acceptable, the Iranian nuclear program. It's conceivable that the American approach of using sanctions, and certainly President Obama deserves kudos and as does the Democratic Congress, for ratcheting up those sanctions to the point that they are obviously hurting inside of Iran. So, succinctly put, I think the arguments in favor of a strike are pretty good, even though the repercussions of that strike for Israel and for the United States could be quite severe, but less severe than actually allowing Khamenei and the Guard Corps to have nuclear weapons.
Well, you certainly put a lot on the table, and I certainly want to respond to various issues that you raised. But I also, if you'd allow me, I wanted to ask a clarifying question. At least the way that Jeffrey Goldberg reports it, there is not doesn't seem to be a particular inclination in Israel to strike now, to strike today, next week, next month, probably even through the end of this calendar year 2010. The scenario that Goldberg lays out has the Israelis, you know, coming to a decision point, you know, probably by the summer of 2011. In your view, the way you look at it, is there some critical threshold that still needs to be crossed in terms of whatever state of development Iran's nuclear program is in to justify a decision to attack? Or is, as far as you're concerned, the Iranian program as it exists today would merit that sort of response? And, you know, if the Israelis end up delaying for various political considerations, you know, that's a different issue. But the threat that would warrant a military response, it is in existence today.
I mean, I think the principal trouble for the Israelis, and it's the same one liberal democracies always have when they confront any military situation of any gravity, is they'll postpone and delay as long as possible. I think it would have been a lot better for the United States to attack that program a while ago. I think the damage that could have been done to it and done to the scientific staff, because the Iranians do not have a deep bench when it comes to the nuclear program, it would have been more effective a few years ago than today. But I'm not sure what I think the Israeli military calculations are probably already set. The only thing that would change that scenario, and I'm not sure whether the Israelis have decided to actually do that. I have heard that the Air Force has done a substantial review, and their view is they can't pull this off. If that's true, then the only factor that would, technical factor that would change their calculations would be the introduction of new aircraft weaponry in Iran, specifically the transfer of, say, an S-300 from the Russians or a Russian ally, which would, I think, accelerate that timetable. Otherwise, I don't think there is anything in the Iranian nuclear program itself that's probably slowing down the Israeli calculation. I mean, it's possible that, I mean, the Iranians appear to have had some technical difficulties. I think it's fair to say that even though this achievement is an enormous one for them and quite rightly should be seen as sort of their Manhattan Project, because I think the initial Iranian reaction to when the program was revealed in 2002 was that the Iranian people were astonished. Because they had held their own regime to be so incompetent in such difficult scientific matters. So though they've had difficulties, I don't think those are difficulties are probably sufficient to convince the Israelis that the Iranians are going to have a long-term problem with constructing a nuclear weapon.
Well, I find it remarkable. I mean, if I understand you right, you're saying that the Iranian nuclear program as it exists today, or even as it existed, you know, perhaps back in 2003, was, you know, a sufficient and even existential threat to Israel to warrant a military response. I mean, let's start out by just taking a look at what is the Iranian nuclear program.
Well, no, I mean, if the issue is, do you think they're trying to develop a nuclear weapon? I think the concerted opinion amongst all of the allied powers, United States and the European Western powers who've been involved with this, principally the EU3, the British, the French, and the Germans, is that they are gunning for a nuclear weapons program. I don't know anyone who believes they're not. So the issue would be, when do you think it's a good idea to strike it? Do you believe it's a good idea to wait until the very last moment before they cross that threshold, which your intelligence will not be able to confirm? Or do you think it's a better idea to strike it sooner when you can do the most damage?
Well, I guess I'd push back right there. I don't think there is any evidence that Iran has taken a decision to assemble nuclear weapons.
I don't know. If they have or have not, but certainly the clandestine way, the mendacious way that they've conducted the nuclear program, the fact that we have caught them with plans for nuclear warhead designs, it really leaves, I think, little doubt that that is in their calculations. I strongly suspect that the defectors who've come in, say, in the last 2 years, have caused some internal indigestion inside of the intelligence community. Whether they have made the decision to actually assemble it, I think, is irrelevant, since none of us are going to know that probably until the moment they explode a nuclear device.
I don't think it is irrelevant. I mean, what we know about the Iranian program is that they are working in a concerted way to develop an indigenous capability to enrich uranium. They've enriched a certain amount of uranium at 3 to 4%. They have started enriching much smaller amounts of uranium at close to 20%. Under the NPT, all of this is still in the category of low-level enrichment. There is absolutely not one shred of evidence that the Iranians have ever enriched anything at anywhere close to the level required for weapons-grade fissile material, and there's no evidence that they have diverted any of their uranium enriched or otherwise.
Well,
and so what we are getting spun up about, pardon the pun, what we're getting spun up about is that the Iranians are learning how to enrich uranium.
I just beg to differ with you, Flynn. If you really do think that they have spent this massive fortune, have a clandestine program, have imported weapons designs, which the IAEA actually did catch them. I mean, there are documents there that are quite inexplicable. They're doing all of this because they want to have enough fuel to run a medical research reactor, then I really would like to play poker with you, because
that's not what I mean.
It's just not reasonable.
Why is it not reasonable to interpret what they're doing as an effort to learn how to enrich uranium? And yes, there are.
And I think they would have. I think from the very beginning they would have done this overtly as members of the NPT. Had make it right up in front. They didn't do that. In fact, they've done just the opposite. They've done everything to convince folks that they're gunning for a nuclear weapon. Listen, in 2003, when the Europeans decided that they were going to get involved with the Iranian negotiations, and the Bush administration mm-hmm. said, "Go ahead." I think it's fair to say that if you'd gone, and I actually did go, to the French, the Germans, and the British, and talked to them about the Iranian nuclear program, particularly in Berlin and London, not in Paris, which has always been more skeptical, you would have found many people to say, well, we're not quite sure what the Iranians are really doing, et cetera, et cetera. If you go back to those folks today and ask them, what do you think the Iranians are doing? I guarantee you they will tell you they're trying to build a nuclear weapon. It's just no longer a feasible proposition on your part to argue that, oh, they're just doing this because they want to have an indigenous nuclear program. And, you know, one day the Iranians are going to run out of oil and gas and they want to have a backup. If the Iranians...
That's not what I'm saying.
If you are saying that they are developing the nuclear program to develop weapons, then it becomes really a technical and tactical issue, if you believe that is unacceptable. That it is unacceptable to have a regime that always ranks as the number one terrorist supporting state in the world. That if you have,
according to the U.S. State Department.
Yes, according to the U.S. State Department, your State Department and mine. If you believe that a regime that has had contact with the worst terrorist organizations, that under Rafsanjani, it was actually a more or less a religion to call these conventions to Iran. And where that's the pragmatic Rafsanjani, where you would bring in rejectionist Islamic radicals to Tehran who openly aspired to attack Israel. That a regime that has actually aided and supported the Islamic radical groups, terrorist groups that are attacking Israel. A regime that actually had contact with Al-Qaeda after the attacks in Africa in 1998, where it became crystal clear what Al-Qaeda was all about, that this is a regime that allowed these members of Al-Qaeda to have free movement into Iran and out, and that you are going to grant this regime, grant the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the most radical organization inside of Iran. We're not talking about the late Ayatollah Muqtadiri. We're not talking about the exiled Abdelkarim Soroush. We're not talking about the moderates who make up the Green Movement. We're talking about the most radical of the radical who have adamantly refused to come to the to talk to Barack Hussein Obama, who has said many times, pretty please, let's just talk. That you're going to let them have a nuclear program? I would say no. Strike it.
No, it's not a question of letting them have it. It's a question of, you know, what are the rules that govern this, and what are the responses that are legitimately available to...
Well, since they have been in violation of the NPT repeatedly, and the IAEA has...
No, they are not in
violation.
Well,
yes, they are. They lied. They have lied from the beginning.
They have never been found in violation of the NPT.
They lied about their initial program. They will not explain some of the documents that have been found. They lie about the secret sites that get discovered. They are, I mean, the mendacity of the regime on this issue is astounding.
Neither the International Atomic Energy Agency nor the Security Council has ever declared the Iranians to be in breach of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is simply a matter of fact, however inconvenient it might be. What you're spun up about is that the Iranians are learning how to enrich uranium. And yes, the more that they learn how to enrich uranium, yes, that could be used as the building block for a nuclear weapons program. That is inherent in any fuel cycle program anywhere in the world, and it's no less the case in Iran than it is in other situations. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, no matter, you know, how much people want to say that there's evidence that they were exploring this engineering problem or that engineering problem that is connected with ultimately assembling nuclear weapons, there is no evidence that they are enriching at weapons grade, that they are diverting nuclear material from the international inspection process.
Clint, I got a simple question.
There's no evidence that they are actually physically working to fabricate weapons.
Do you think they're trying to make a nuclear weapon?
No, I think let me answer your question. Yeah. I think they are trying to learn the basic building blocks and be seen as having the building blocks that would be required were they ever to take a decision to build nuclear weapons. But that is a different matter from actually assembling, fabricating, testing weapons.
No, I think the matter is if the regime, and I've already described over and over again the nature of this regime, and that is the most...
That
is the most important element. This regime is not trying to build a nuclear weapon, is not trying to build a building blocks. And I'll grant you that I don't think they've gotten there yet, because if they had gotten there, I think they would test, because they would want us to know that they haven't gotten there. Then the objective ought to be to have them not get there. And
Ruel, in the Iran-Iraq war, they were actually attacked with chemical weapons. and they deliberately took a decision that they were not going to weaponize their own chemical agents, were not going to respond in kind, even though Saddam had initiated the use of chemical weapons against them.
Well, I think...
I don't know where you get... I mean, what is the historical basis for saying that if they were able to build a nuclear weapon, that they could? We have an historical precedent in which they had been attacked by chemical weapons, they had an option for assembling and using chemical weapons, and they chose not to take...
That's because the regime was in free fall at that time. And if you go back and look at what happened in 87, basically the regime was totally reeling. The Revolutionary Guard Corps was in a state of collapse, and the desire was to end the war. And it finally, Khamenei and Rafsanjani were finally able to convince Khomeini to end it. That the last thing they wanted to do was continue, because if they continued, there was an excellent chance that the Guard Corps was going to come apart. If the Guard Corps comes apart, the whole regime comes apart. It wasn't because
The one precedent that we have, they did not, even after having been attacked with weapons of mass destruction, and they had a response which they could have pursued, they did not pursue it. That is the historical record.
Yeah, well, I would grant you that they didn't launch. I would also grant you that the primary reason they didn't launch is after the Iraqis had let loose and the entire front line of the Iranians was on the verge of total collapse, that the overwhelming push amongst the leaders of the regime, Khomeini being the exception, was to stop the war, that the war itself could bring down the state. And that the introduction of those weapons would in fact prolong the war and could have ended up with the entire regime going under. I think
Khomeini did not take the decision to end the war until 1988, after the United States shot down a civilian airline.
Yeah, but Rafsanjani's commentary on this is pretty damn clear, and that is that he wanted out of the war. And he was the driving force at that time. Khomeini, I think it is fair to say, is a rock of Gibraltar, and it took him a bit of time to realize that they were in desperate state. The accidental attack by the Americans on an Iranian Airbus also helped, of course.
Yeah, whether it's accidental or not, or whether it's
Flint, stop the conspiracy. Stop the conspiracy theories. The United States Navy did not intentionally shoot down an Iranian Airbus.
That's not the issue of the day.
Think that, you should perhaps write on that. That would be an interesting exposition.
The issue that you've raised and that you put front and center is the nature of the regime.
Yeah, true.
I think that what you've said about the regime is, to me, just a caricature. You know, the fact of the matter is that the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside of Israel lives in Iran. It's 25 to 30,000 people who are not in any way persecuted.
Oh, Flint, that's nonsense.
I used to Iranians who have a guaranteed seat in the parliament.
Flint, you do yourself a great disservice. I mean, I used to be in Istanbul. I was working there. I dealt with hundreds of Iranian Jews who were fleeing that regime in the 1980s and 1990s. I can guarantee you I didn't find a single Iranian Jew who said, oh, we're in great shape. That's, you know, we just want to go to Europe. We want to go to Israel. We want to go to America because things are hunky-dory. You have 25 or 30,000 Jews left in Iran because you've got a Jewish community in Iran for 2,500 years. It's a very difficult thing for an established community, a conservative traditional community, to leave its homeland. That community has been harassed. Leaders of that community have regularly been charged with espionage. It used to be a pet theme for the regime to charge leaders of the Jewish community with pederasty. It is a very unpleasant situation. And that you would actually suggest that things are nice, I have to say, leads me to believe that your analytical abilities on this may have ulterior motives, because it's just absurd. Absurd.
I don't have any ulterior motives here, except unless you want to call an ulterior motive to keep people in the neoconservative camp from pushing the United States into an unnecessary and counterproductive war in the Middle East on the basis of a, you know,
manufactured. How many Iranian Jews have you? How many Iranian Jews have you spoken to away from an official monitor?
I don't know. I haven't count.
Did you do that on your recent Potemkin Village tour of Iran?
I don't go on Potemkin Village tours.
Oh, well,
I mean, the fact of the matter on the, is
how about the state the state supported
community.
The state supported tour, the ones that gave you the visas. Did you go?
The Iranian government has never paid for any of my travel.
Have you ever spoken to Iranian Jewish refugees either in Israel, the United States, or in Europe? Ever?
In the United States, yes.
Yeah, and may I ask, what did they tell you? Did they tell you that things were fine in Iran?
Well, by definition, they were refugees. They were people who had left the Islamic Republic because they didn't want to live there. I have met far more Iranians living in the United States who left the Islamic Republic who weren't Jewish, but who chose to leave.
Iran has a huge problem with brain drain. People tend to leave the country, particularly if they
if they're well
educated.
The Jews who have remained in Iran, and it is the largest Jewish community in the region at this point outside of Israel, that, you know, I don't see any evidence of persecution. I don't see any evidence that these people are discriminated against by the government, by the law. They are, you know, given full freedom to practice their religion, to, you know, live in the way that they wish to live, and I don't think that it's, you know, it doesn't fit in well with your case that this is a virulently anti-Semitic regime that's out to finish Hitler's work, to have this Jewish community there, you know, living in the status that they live.
The Iranian Jewish community is completely humbled, completely. They also are, to some extent, let's be crystal clear on this, though the regime has often done its best to ignore Islamic law, and will ignore it when it really sees fit. Khomeini made quite crystal clear on that. If the choice is between the Sharia or himself, you choose him. There are certain precedents, and as long as the Jews live as dhimmis, and I don't think I need to explain to you what that is, as long as they live as in their second-class status, then they can continue in Iran. They will be harassed. They may get charged with pederasty. They may get regularly charged with espionage, which is absurd. But they can continue to exist there, that they're not going to be slaughtered. They oppose no threat to the Iranian state. As Khomeini made crystal clear in repeated statements, which I think you tend to ignore, Jews elsewhere do. And it's the Jews elsewhere, in Israel and in the United States, and in South America, where the Iranians sent assassination teams to kill Jews, you will find that they view that differently. Now, I mean, I have a historical question for you, and that is, in 1981, when the Israelis struck the Oseroc reactor, would you have come down on the side of Ronald Reagan or on the side of George H.W. Bush and in opposing or being in favor of that attack? Was that a good thing to do in 1981, striking that reactor, or was that a mistake? Should have tried to stop it.
I would have opposed the attack, and I think in retrospect that position is vindicated, because what we know is that it is in the aftermath of the Oseroc attack that Saddam's nuclear weapons efforts actually accelerated. They went underground. They intensified. You know, the reason why he was so close to, you know, it's, you know, the urban mythology is that he had not gotten to a nuclear weapon by the time we fought the first Gulf War because of what the Israelis did at Oseroc. I think if you actually read what the inspectors found after we went into Iraq after the first Gulf War, that an accurate reading of events is that as a result of Oseroc,
that's an ex post facto. I think I don't recall anybody. I don't recall James Baker or George H.W. Bush making that argument in 1981. I'm saying, based on the information that you would have known in 1981, would you have been in favor or not in favor of the Israeli strike on Oseroc against Saddam Hussein.
And I said I would not have been. I would have been opposed to it. And I think would you have been opposed? Would you call it ex post facto?
Would you have been opposed to it if in fact, let's change the historical record, but let's just assume that if they hadn't done it, Saddam Hussein would have gotten a nuclear weapon. Would you have rather had Saddam with a nuclear weapon or seen an Israeli strike? Granted,
he was never going to get grant me the
philosophical disposition and just say
no. I'm not going to do
okay.
that.
All right, let's move on. Do you think the Israeli attack on the North Korean aided, and I strongly suspect also Iranian aided nuclear program, nuclear plant at Deir ez-Zor in Syria, that the strike in 2007? Would you have sided with George W. Bush or Condi Rice? Was that a good idea or a bad idea?
I don't think that was a good idea.
Okay. Now, let me just, the Americans, I assume that you wouldn't have been in favor of a strike on the Dimona reactor in Israel before the Israelis developed a nuclear weapon. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you would have been in favor of American preemptive strike on the Dimona reactor. Would you have been in favor, for example, of a massive U.S. sanctions regime against Israel to stop it from developing a nuclear weapon?
I'm not a big fan of sanctions against anybody. I think sanctions are a really lousy and pretty misguided foreign policy.
Okay, but do you think the United States should have aggressively taken aim at the Israeli nuclear program in its development and opposed Israel's development of nuclear weapons and fought the French in their support of Israel, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't think Israel's nuclear weapons capability serves American interests.
Okay, all right. That's I just wanted to get a good basis on whether on where you stand on previous preemption and also the Israeli.
We're not even talking about preemption here. We're talking about preventive war. We're not talking about some imminent threat which you may then decide to preempt.
That's fine. I'm fine. I mean, if you want to preventive war, if you want to use the term preventive, that's fine with me. Rather than preemption, I don't have a strong objection to that.
Okay, but you know, let's get back to talking about the regime for a minute. This is also a political order that, you know, however much, you know, you want to try and find this statement by that Iranian politician and characterize it as anti-Semitic. The fact of the matter is that no Iranian leader, you know, including President Ahmadinejad, no Iranian leader has ever threatened to destroy Israel by initiating the military force.
I think they'd be a bit of an idiotic to actually do that before they actually get a nuke. I mean, if you really want to galvanize Netanyahu and conceivably even Barack Obama, into using a preemptive strike against your nuclear program, then you would say, of course, we intend to use military power to obliterate the state of Israel. But I just suggest to you, I mean, it's just a wild suggestion, that when Ahmadinejad, and I think he's actually polite compared to Khamenei, when you have Ahmadinejad use the verb Mahdeh Shodan, and since you know Arabic, you know where that comes from. It comes from Maha. And that is pretty clearly that means to obliterate, to eradicate. I think that's, you know, it's not the word.
It's what we would call a passive construction.
Well, but that's commonly used, actually. Very commonly used in Persian.
It's not the person is not who's using it is not saying, I will do this.
Yeah.
He's saying, yeah, this will occur, and then he explains how it will occur, which is basically through demographics.
At the time that Ahmadinejad said that, he wasn't talking, I don't think, about demographics. But when you put that language together, and again, I think the man is quite capable of choosing other verbs. When you put that language together with the fact that the regime has supported terrorist groups for a long time.
Let's come back to who they've supported.
They support Hamas.
They support Hezbollah. They support these groups because, as they would present it, these groups are resisting Israeli occupation. Well, and I think from a strategic perspective, these groups for a country, let's keep in mind, Iran is a country that basically cannot project military, conventional military force beyond its borders.
Well,
you know,
well,
it hasn't invaded
anybody. Well, no, Iran,
it's
Iran,
not going to invade
Iran,
anybody.
Iran has been, well, in the future, I don't know. I mean, the future's a long way off, and we'll see what happens. But I would agree with you that the regime has had a love affair with the use of terrorism. And the terrorism and is its chief means.
But they use this in a quite strategic and
really,
tactically
really, when
deliberate
way. Was the attack in Argentina against Jewish community centers, was that strategic? Slaughtering innocent Argentine Jews, was that strategic? Was the attack on the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, was that strategic?
According to Richard Clark and Steve Simon, who were the principal NSC officers for counterterrorism at the time of the Khobar Towers attack, they have said and written publicly that to the extent that Iran was involved in sponsoring that attack, and that itself is something which has, I don't think, ever been definitively laid out, but let's assume for this discussion that there was an Iranian hand in it. According to Richard Clark and Steve Simon, the Iranians did that in response to the U.S. Congress having appropriated for the first time and President Clinton having signed into law an appropriations bill that appropriated money to promote the destabilization of the Islamic Republic.
Oh.
Now, we may not like what happened at Khobar Towers. We may not like the tactic that was chosen, but this was not, you know, this was not some random.
I think you've just proved the case that if the United States government does anything the regime doesn't like, they're going to hit you with terrorism. They're going to kill American citizens. I mean, let me just read for a second, because this often gets.
No, I don't know who sponsored Khobar Towers.
Well, let's
saying that even if you accept this story that the Iranians were behind Khobar Towers, that even people like Richard Clark and Steve Simon will say that from an Iranian perspective, this was a reactive event. It was a defensive pushback against what they saw as U.S. aggression against them.
Well, that,
and
that,
so what I'm
Flint,
saying
Flint,
is,
we can argue about whether it's defensive or offensive, and frankly, I don't care. The end result is that they bombed an American facility and they killed American soldiers. That is simply taboo. It's a no-no. And if, again, let me just read something. This is the 9/11 Commission report. It says, as we mentioned in Chapter 2, while in Sudan, senior managers in al-Qaeda maintained contacts with Iran and the Iranian-supported worldwide terrorist organization Hezbollah, which is based mainly in southern Lebanon and Beirut. Al-Qaeda members received advice and training from Hezbollah. Intelligence indicates the persistence of contacts between Iranian security officials and senior al-Qaeda figures after bin Laden's return to Afghanistan. Khalad has said that Iran made a concerted effort to strengthen relations with al-Qaeda after the October 2000 attack on the USS Cole, but was rebuffed because bin Laden did not want to alienate his supporters in Saudi Arabia. Khalad and other detainees have described the willingness of Iranian officials to facilitate the travel of al-Qaeda members through Iran on their way to and from Afghanistan. For example, Iranian border inspectors would be told not to place telltale stamps in the passports of these travelers. Such arrangements were particularly beneficial to Saudi members of al-Qaeda. I can go on and read and read and read.
Look, I read the 9/11 Commission report, but I can also tell you from my own direct experience that after 9/11, the Iranians provided the United States critical assistance in getting rid of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. In trying to round
up. Well, actually,
up
I don't think that's true.
I think
if we brought in Nick Burns right now and had a discussion with Nick Burns and asked him, did the Iranians.
Nick Burns wasn't working this issue in 2001.
No, he was the ambassador in NATO, and he became the number three at state. I think Nick would have a damn good idea. If we asked Nick and said, oh, Nick, do you really think?
Why don't you bring in Ryan Crocker and ask him?
I would mind bringing Ryan Crocker on this, and I think the key.
Why don't you bring in my wife, who actually negotiated with the Iranians over this episode?
I think the key point on this
the
is that
the key point is that the key they point held us the key the key and the
I think the key point is after the Iranians saw the Americans storm into Afghanistan all right, and take down the Taliban regime and drive al-Qaeda out. Well, regrettably, we didn't move fast enough. And, you know, in 2003, when supposedly, you're a big fan of this, supposedly the Iranians then came to the United States via the Swiss ambassador and said, oh, please, 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 let's talk. If they did that, which I don't really think they did, but if they did that, the primary factor driving them was, of course, the fact that the Americans had just taken Saddam Hussein down in a very short period of time, something they tried to do in years of warfare and when able. It was, in fact, the fear of the United States that drove the Iranians to cooperate to the extent that they did in Afghanistan. And
I trust
James Dobbins. And if James Dobbins says the Iranians were helpful in Afghanistan, and I assume the man, he's a sensible individual.
And he says they were helpful.
And he says they were helpful. And I have no doubt that the Iranians were helpful. And I also suggest to you they didn't have much choice since they were in panic. That the Americans were actually going to aim after them next, because let us not forget, as you no doubt remember and you were objected to, that George W. Bush did refer to them as part of the Axis of Evil. And there was considerable concern in Tehran that another axis might actually fall.
But they continued to work with us until we cut off the dialogue with them over Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in May of 2003.
I don't know, because
you said they had their own interests in Afghanistan and vis-a-vis al-Qaeda, but they also cooperated with us because they wanted to use it as an opportunity to get us to rethink our fundamental attitude toward the Islamic Republic.
I'm extremely dubious that if you went back to our former employer and asked them, they said, did the Iranians give you any information that substantively helped us to battle al-Qaeda? I think the answer to that would probably be no. If you also ask them, did they bother to turn over any senior members of al-Qaeda who had fled into Iran? The answer to that is no.
They turned over more than 200
Oh, give me a break.
Barbara
Slavin is the one who put that out, and I tried to actually track this down, trying to find any senior member of al-Qaeda, any known member of al-Qaeda that had any value. I'm not talking about, you know, sort of the cannon fodder that comes from the Taliban. And I've yet to be able to find them. I've asked European intelligence officials. I've asked Arab intelligence officials. Has anybody seen these guys? No one has seen them. I think it's a myth.
It's documented.
Where? Show me. I haven't seen a single American official reference senior members of al-Qaeda being turned over. Who are they? Where are they? Where do they go?
They turned over more than 200.
Where did they go, Flint?
They turned over the passport pages to Kofi Annan at the UN.
No.
Passport pages?
What are you talking about? Where are they? If they had senior members of al-Qaeda,
if I can't finish the sentence, then I can't
finish the
sentence. You know, they turned over the passport pages, and then they repatriated as many of these people as they could to their countries of origin. They repatriated several dozen to the Saudis, although the Saudis have only publicly acknowledged 17. They repatriated a good number to the new Afghan government under Karzai. There were other bilateral repatriations.
Let me suggest to you that none of these individuals were senior members of al-Qaeda. They certainly weren't bin Laden's son. And let me also suggest that I'm highly dubious of actually the ones who supposedly were turned over. Whether they ended up in prison or whether they, in fact, rejoined the outfit. I think a lot of this is just nonsense, and it's been passed on, and it hasn't been investigated. And I suspect if we were to go back to our former employer and apply a little muscle and manpower, we would not be impressed with the Iranian contribution to the war against al-Qaeda. And why do you think the Iranians were in fact dealing with al-Qaeda before 9/11? Were they doing it just for sport?
I don't know for a fact that they were dealing with al-Qaeda, and to the extent that there may have been some contacts with, you know, Pasdaran people or others with some al-Qaeda elements, You know, I don't think there was any measure of strategic or tactical
support. Oh, so you think a member of the Revolutionary Guard Corps would go out and have a liaison relationship with Al Qaeda and not get permission from Khamenei to do so?
I don't know that that happened.
Well, I mean, I would suggest to you that if you do believe that a member of the Pastoran would, for example, go out and have an unsanctioned contact with the Revolutionary Guard Corps, that the last people on the planet that you want to have control of the nuclear weaponry in Iran, and if someday they may get it,
who would be with the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Ruel, just let me ask you, who do you think has provided, by orders of magnitude, more support to Al-Qaeda? The Pakistani intelligence service or the Iranians? The Saudi intelligence service?
I don't think Pakistani intelligence has. I'm guessing here. All right, but I don't think Pakistani intelligence ever knowingly supplied and aided Al Qaeda in an attack against the United States.
I'm just asking who provided more support to Al Qaeda?
Oh, there's no
Pakistan
no,
and
there's
Saudi
no,
Arabia.
No,
or
there's no there's
Iran.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt that ISI and the Pakistani military. In the 1990s, co-located their Kashmiri training camps and assisted Al-Qaeda's training efforts in Afghanistan. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, the Pakistanis are guilty of sin. And if I had my druthers, I would hold the Pakistanis much more accountable on that, though I must say, I think the Pakistanis now are probably getting a bum rap because I think the tide has changed somewhat. And when you
do you want to bomb Pakistan?
No, I don't want to bomb Pakistan. But I certainly don't want if I have an option in Iran to stop a regime that knowingly was aiding and abetting. And I think the principal reason that they were making contact with Al-Qaeda is they were actually an effective radical Sunni group that could draw American blood. I mean, that's what the conferences were all about in the 1990s that Rafsanjani orchestrated. It was because he wanted to – the Iranians at the very beginning of the revolution wanted to be on the cutting edge of the anti-American movement in the Islamic world. They believed in ecumenicalism where many of their Sunni counterparts did not. They brought
when
people.
When is the last time, by your estimation, when is the last time that the Iranians were involved in some way in a terrorist operation that resulted in the deaths of Americans?
Well, I mean, if you exclude their aiding and abetting of the folks in Iraq and probably in Afghanistan, then I'd say 1996. And as you will recall, Rafsanjani made a pretty well-known speech, I think it was at the very end of 1996, beginning of 1977, after the Khobar Towers incident, where I call that we've been lucky speech, where Rafsanjani essentially says that we've been pushing the envelope here. Now, he doesn't explicitly say, oh, we did Khobar Towers. But what I think he is really saying is that the emphasis here has to go elsewhere, and the elsewhere was actually, I think, on the nuclear program, and what they also had developed at that time, which scared the bejesus out of Khamenei, was the growth of the reform movement under Khatami. And they shifted inwards. Instead of directing assassination teams to Europe and elsewhere, they actually directed assassination teams at their own reformists and started killing people inside of Iran and arresting people and attacking the reform movement, because in the end, that's what scares the regime the most is the reform movement, which, by the way, I think you belittle on almost an unconscionable level.
Look, I think that, you know, so by your own estimation, the Iranians have not been involved in a terrorist attack that targeted Americans since 1996, and they don't have nuclear weapons.
I don't think there's an expiration date on terrorism against the United States. Unless you can show to me that the Iranians have actually evolved, that I would argue that Khamenei has gotten worse since 1996. Now, lots of Iranians have evolved. I mean, the folks that you belittle in the Green Movement, who represent truly a second intellectual revolution in Iran, and that much of the clergy Much of the secular Iranians, religious Iranians who have become much, much more secular, who drove the revolutionary movement in 1977, 78, and 79, these folks have evolved.
I don't belittle reformists or anybody else in Iran. I do belittle American analysts who made a lot more out of the Green Movement than was actually there and wanted us to hang our policy toward Iran on an illusion.
Well, no. I think it would be news to a lot of people who look at Iran that you did not belittle the Green Movement. Two, the notion of hanging American policy, I would argue, should back democracy in Iran. It should back reform. It should do that without any hesitation and quite clearly.
American policy should support American interests.
Yeah, and American interests are definitely the growth of democracy in Iran. I don't know what a democracy would do in Iran, but I strongly suspect that the one thing if a democratic Iran wanted to develop a nuclear weapon, and I'm very doubtful that it would, but if it wanted to, it would be an entirely different creature than having the Revolutionary Guard Corps and Ali Khamenei develop a nuclear weapon. I think we and the Israelis could be a lot calmer about the issue.
If we end up attacking Iran, Ruel, or Israel does, we're going to be attacking them because we don't like the idea that they're learning some of the things that they might need to know someday if they ever wanted to build a nuclear weapon. And I think that is a really lousy reason to start another war.
I can't think of a better reason to start a conflict than to stop such a regime from obtaining nuclear weapons. I don't find it that hard of a call. I'm not going to deny for a moment that the repercussions of that could not be quite severe. They could be. The Iranians have a penchant for terrorism. I should say the Iranian regime has a penchant for terrorism, which I think is unrivaled in the Middle East, with a possible exception by al-Qaeda. And so that any strike on Iran could definitely provoke the Iranians to strike us. But any regime that would use terrorism in the first place, that has a track record of use, that has the track record of having the most nefarious associations, should not under any circumstances have a nuclear weapon. And I think it shows you the distance we traveled from 9/11, where so many people are somewhat nonchalant about this issue. I think it's a serious mistake. And it is conceivably preventable by a military strike.
About the nuclear weapon as if it is a matter of fact that they have nuclear weapons. They do not have nuclear weapons.
I would agree with that. Right now they don't. And the last thing, a preventive strike after they get it, it's not going to do you any good. And since we were both in the agency, we both know that you are not going to get, unless you're really lucky with an incredible walk-in, and you'd have to probably have two walk-ins to verify the information, if not more. You're not going to know that moment. You're not even going to get close to that red line. What you have to do is you have to assess the information you have, look at their behavior, look at their clandestine pattern with the nuclear development, and most importantly, look at the nature of the regime and say, do you want these folks to have a nuclear weapon? And I don't. Now, I'm all in favor for trying a bit longer. We're going to have a long time from
here. So we're going to go to war because someday we think they might.
Well, I don't think.
Listen, I
think the more likely calculation, and this is about the Americans, not the Israelis. They have their own calculations here. I think it's much more likely that the United States will end up in a war with Iran, not because of anything the United States does, but because the Iranians miscalculate, because the regime, which has a consistent hubristic streak in it, actually believes that its progress with nuclear weaponry or its obtaining nuclear weapons somehow insulates it and allows it to act in provocative ways which will not have adverse repercussions. I think it's much more likely the regime, as it gets closer and closer to the nuclear weaponry, will become more and more provocative and actually conceivably provoke even someone like Barack Obama, who obviously doesn't want to have a military confrontation with Iran, into having one. That's, I think, the more likely scenario, is the Iranian regime, because of its own behavior, because of its own hubristic ways, will actually bring on their own military demise.
Well, they're telling me we need to wrap it up, but I really do find it astounding that after the debacle of Iraq, that there are still people who want to make the argument that we should be going to war with this, you know, important country in the Middle East because of what we think they might do or what might happen. I think that is a very, very dangerous basis for making policy.
Well, we can argue a later day on whether the Iraq was a debacle. I tend to side with the Shiites and Kurds. That's 80% of the Iraqi population that it wasn't. And I think the Middle East and the world is a vastly better place.
That
Saddam Hussein's not there.
I think the debacle for the United States.
I disagree. I think eliminating Saddam Hussein was a worthwhile thing to do. And both the world, the Middle East, and us were in a better shape for it. And certainly for the Iraqi people, for the Shiites and Kurds, it's a better place. Now, on the Iranian regime, if there has been anyone out there who has been more open to negotiations and discussions, it has to be. Barack Obama.
But he's not prepared to put anything on the table.
Oh, sure, yes. He's begged Khamenei to come to the table to talk.
Khamenei has continued to fund operations that end up killing people in Iran.
Yes, now what?
Sorry?
I don't know what you're talking about. Flint, I have no idea what you're talking about there. If you're talking about supposed covert actions, that's a myth. But Barack Obama has gone out of his way to be nice, to invite negotiations.
It's not enough to be nice. You actually have to put something on the table.
If Khamenei would just send someone, he could send anybody. Just send somebody and say, hi, let's have a chat.
He did. He sent Saeed Jalili.
He has to do. He says, let's talk about everything. Khamenei won't do that. Every time Barack Obama tries to have a conversation with him, Khamenei lets loose a barrage against the United States. I mean, calling the United States Satan incarnate after
he said in response to the first Nowruz message, 2 days later in Mashhad, the Supreme Leader said, you say you want to change. The United States has done all these bad things to Iran. But this is a new administration. We don't have experience with this Obama administration. And President Obama says he wants to change. Fine. You change your policies towards us, and we will change, too. From the Iranian perspective, there has been no meaningful change in the U.S. posture towards
That would be news to the entire Green Movement and all the people who took the streets and who were shouting, Obama, he is with us. I mean, I think that's just preposterous. Iranian officials off the record have actually often made it quite clear that Barack Obama is different. The problem is not the Americans, Flint. We're not at fault. It's not the Americans who are demonizing Iran. It's the Iranians who are demonizing America. Not that many Iranians. Unfortunately, the regime at top. And so I think your analysis here.
Diplomatic record.
No, that's I don't want to say. That many great things of Barack Obama, but Barack Obama has actually, I mean, he has offered the Iranians an extended hand over and over and over again.
The regime
has slapped it over and over and over again.
He has offered the Iranians nothing substantively. He has offered them a nicer rhetorical presentation, at least initially, compared with George Bush. But in terms of substance, he has not offered
Khamenei had sent the foreign minister and said, he's coming to Washington right now, we're going to have negotiations, I guarantee...
That's not the way it works.
He could send him to Geneva. He could pick a spot. I guarantee you that the sanctions that have currently been implemented wouldn't have come about. I guarantee you it would have happened. The Iranians have brought this on themselves because, in fact, they want to have a nuclear weapons program. They do not want to compromise it. And what Thérèse Delpech has been saying for years after being involved with them in the EU3 is true, and that is negotiations for them are just simply a stalling mechanism. What they're after is a nuclear bomb, period.
I think we ought to try actually negotiating with them and find out. But let's wrap this up. I'll hit my button now.
All right. Ciao.